Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn, Germany. On this week's show, we are going to be analyzing the song Seven Nation Army, the omnipresent anthem of soccer teams around the world and the unofficial tournament song of the World Cup. Why do groups of people sing this song together? What is so special about it? What is going on in our brain when we sing it together? And does it say something about the power of music? If you have ever wondered about this, definitely stick around with me on this episode of Spectrum, or even if you just like this song, I promise it'll be worth it.
DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
So there I am, sitting in on our morning conference in the DW Science Department. This is Monday morning, but 10 a.m. local German time. Absolutely no idea what I'm going to do on this week's show. And Zulfikar Abani, my colleague and the Kyrios of the English DW Science Desk, starts talking about the song Seven Nation Army. You know, the one that's become the World Cup anthem and is also sung by fans of soccer teams and all kinds of other sports as a kind of rallying cry all over the world. Why is that? I got to thinking, what a great idea for a show. And here we are, all thanks to Zulfikar. You're trying to solo on it?
Yeah, I am. Solo. All the way to hell and back.
That melody. Seven. Was it Seven Army
Nation? Seven Nation Army. Get it right, man.
Seven Nation Army. I got it. White Stripes.
White Stripes.
When did that thing come out?
I think it was around 2003, something like that, when they brought out the album Elephant, or White Elephant, or Pink Elephant, or something like that. It's about the only hit they ever had.
Do you remember? Were you a White Stripes fan?
I was never a White Stripes fan. I tell you, Gabriel, I do remember the day I walked into the Rough Trade shop in Notting Hill Gate in London, town of my old birth. You know, that's actually done really weird, isn't it? Do I have a new birth? I don't know. Anyway,
I didn't even understand what you just said.
No, exactly. I was walking into the Rough Trade shop in London. And Talbot Road, or whatever it's called, and the guys, they're playing the White Blood Cells. I think that was one of the earlier records of the White Stripes. They go, oh, this is the future. I'm like, yeah, no, I don't think so, because it sounds like a very old kind of rock record. I mean, you know, Jack White is great, and Meg White, I think, was the drummer. Great band. I mean, they revolutionised sort of like two... We used to wear power trios. They were the power duo, you know. In Australia, where I spent a lot of time around that time, when the Seven Nation Army... See, it is coming around to the point, right? I'm getting there. There was an Australian band called The Mess Hall, and they were also a power duo, and they were mental. No offence to mental people.
When you heard that song for the first time, did you see what was coming?
Of course, I didn't see what was coming, but you can tell that there's something about it that is completely, it just hits you in the gut. I think it's A, the beat. It's a very sort of like pumping beat. You know, you cannot mistake that. And then you've got this very monotonous bassy guitar. Dun, 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 dun. And you can hear that the bass drum comes in, and you can only stomp your feet to that, right? And it's like it is an army drive, you know. You're not doing some Midwestern, you know, knee slapping, clicking your fingers dance. No, you're going to war. I still haven't worked out what the lyrics are about, but it's no wonder that it's sort of like, you know, mutated into this football terrorist chant. But what?
Not just football.
No, not
pretty
just
much every sport. In the world.
That's true. That's true. And it has been for years. So we're not just talking about this because of the World Cup, but it sort of struck me because of the longevity of it as well. Not least because I'm jealous, because, you know, if you can't write a successful Christmas hit song, you might as well write the Seven Nation Army, because it's kept Jack White in butter and Marmite for years now. But the thing is, that really, I find it is incredibly funny. There are these songs that sort of like take on new lives. And the Seven Nation Army has also gone into politics. So in a country of my birth, right, it's gone into politics. These songs have that sort of way about them. They go into other areas of life. They bleed into everything. So in England, the Labour Party, I'm not going to take too much away, but basically all you need to know, what you're listening for, is the leader of the Labour Party, the opposition party, Labour Party's name, Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, Jeremy Corbyn!
Carry on, Mr. Corbyn.
That was a football stadium packed full of people singing, "Oh,
Jeremy Corbyn."
And that worked.
And how do you do
that
the song
worked.
On that? "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn."
Yeah, that's what you tried before.
That's what I tried before. You say, see, this is the crazy thing is how is it that a song like that is just basically a rock song, becomes so instrumental and is instrumentalized in other ways? I mean, you know, that is
exactly the question that we're going to be looking at.
What happens in the mind? Why is it in your gut, but also in your mind?
We're going to look at the mind later, but let's go to the music first. There's a musicologist right here in Bonn. Let's go ask him, see what's going on with this song, why it's so powerful, why it's still here and around the world.
I'm with you, man.
Okay, I'm sitting with the guy who wrote the book on pop music. He literally did. He wrote a book called, I think it was, What Makes a Hit a Hit?
Yeah, something like that. We call it in German, Warum Hits Hits Werden. Why get hits hits?
This is Volkmar Kramertz, a musicologist here at Bonn University. And I'm going to ask a real simple question. Why is the song Seven Nation Army so popular?
This is a song with a special riff, and there are some songs with special riffs, and all these songs became famous. Okay, what can we start with? Who knows all the lyrics of the songs? Okay, the most people know the story behind the song or so, but it's that one riff. No? We've got other... And so on. It's hard to play, but there are blues roots, but there are definitely rock roots, and all this together suddenly concentrates on this one riff.
You're saying the Seven Nation Army is based in the blues?
Yeah. Okay. It's not just based on blues. It's based on progressive blues. And you can define it because the major six in the scale in major is a major six, in minor it's a minor six. So they mostly try to avoid the six. The big rock songs don't have a six in their melodies. And this riff from the White Stripes, Seven Nation Army, got blue notes and suddenly the minor six.
Where's the minor sixth? Which note is it? That one, right there.
Normally for a blues rock song. It's a bit boring, but... you can't imagine.
No, you need that minor sixth.
You need that one, eh?
Is that what makes this song so appealing?
Kind of very special idea.
It's what grabs you? Is it that minor sixth?
It's what grabs you, no? It's a blues. Okay. The blues songs were... And suddenly comes this... This minor sixth into the game. And he combines that riff... And this gives us suddenly kind of a minor, mellow mood atmosphere. Okay, and this played like an amateur, like someone who's just doing, just by accident, a riff in a studio. It sounds like any bass was grabbed around, any guitar was taken. This is definitely not a special, very high-priced instrument or so. And then they start playing... And they make it on the bass. And even the guitar, when it comes with the power chords, it doesn't sound like a very high-priced instrument, $10,000 up, like normal guitar heroes used to play. But it's a very amateur guitar, like a blues singer who's just taken any inexpensive instrument, and it sounds like improvised, so it comes very naturally.
Okay, so the harmony comes from the blues. What about the rhythm? This...
Okay.
How important do you think that is for the way that the song is used?
Okay. It couldn't be simpler than on the point, no? Buck, buck, buck. It's just like a remembering of the early techno or something like this, no? But nothing takes a mass people more than this just very on the floor rhythm, no?
4-4.
4-on-4, no? It couldn't be simpler, no? But it's so kind of female and kind of human. So it sounds like an amateur who's just going step into the drums and make this 4-on-the-floor, but it sounds like a very warm female drummer sound. You can listen everything in music, and they put this the atmosphere incredibly precise on the tape, and it's really a combination of all these elements.
Do you think the power of this song can be explained by the music? Or is there something else going on? Is there something else about this song that has made it so big?
You have in me, I'm a person who always says it's music which counts. No? It's always music which counts. Yeah, this is a blues scale combined with a minor scale, combined with a triple rhythm, played so in such a manner that everybody thinks I could do it myself. No? And all that identifies everybody so that everybody says, we could do it ourselves. And this is one of the magic moments in that song. But it has that genius rhythm. It has this extract of really important notes, and it packs it together in just one or two bars. That's really a masterpiece of very small work. There are some preceders. They were a little bit more complicated and so, but Jaguar just makes it. And if you go a little bit slower, then you can growl along. Bum, 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 bum. It's really fast, isn't it? Bum, 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 bum. And one of the real magic secrets is it is enough in itself. It doesn't need to go on. It doesn't need a verse. It doesn't need another chorus or something, or hook line or anything like this. It's just enough. And please repeat it. Please repeat it one more time. And go on. And you can go on and on. It's like a loop in itself. It's magic.
A special thanks to Volkmar Kramertz from his office there at Bonn University's music department. It actually might be impossible to answer the question why the Seven Nation Army is such a big deal, or how it came to be. These are probably questions that have no real answer. It's just speculation and theorizing. What we can answer, on the other hand, is why so many people on Earth sing this one song over and over again. It's psychology. Singing together makes us feel together, part of something powerful. That's according to Eric Clark of Oxford University. He's a professor of music psychology. I got him on the phone and wanted to know why, if there are billions of songs out there, do people choose this one particular one and stick with it? Don't human beings want to be original?
Well, I think human beings actually have two kind of inclinations. One is that they want to be unique, but the other is they want to feel kinds of, you know, social bonding and solidarity. And I think that one of the things that communal singing in every kind of culture and in lots of different manifestations shows is that communal singing is a way of people feeling a powerful sense of social solidarity and social bonding. And that is what singing together can do.
Professor Clark, you are a music psychologist, right?
Yep.
How does that work when we sing together? Why does that unite us so on such a powerful level?
Some of the explanations for this phenomenon go back to very kind of biological things, which is that it's been shown that when people do kind of imitative behaviors, and particularly when they collectively perform imitative behaviors in a synchronized fashion, that you get the release of particular kinds of neurohormones in the brain. These are known as endogenous opioids. So they're opioid-type hormones in the brain, which are powerfully associated with social bonding. They're actually the same hormones that are released in kind of sexual activity and in human bonding, mother-infant bonding and stuff like that. So these are very deep-seated, you might say, fundamental aspects of how people are brought together in powerful human relationships. And as I say, it's been shown that with things like if you get rowers to row together in a boat in synchrony, you can show that there are, or a study has shown that there is the release of these endogenous opioids. And similarly, when people dance together, and arguably when they sing together, it tends to be under circumstances when people are doing something relatively energetic and highly synchronized. Now, singing is not a massively energetic thing, but, you know, usually when people are singing their team along or whatever it is to the sound of Seven Nation Army, they're also probably kind of throwing their arms in the air and jigging about, and, in other words, being quite active.
You mentioned the biological aspect there. Perhaps on a deeper level, my colleague this week, the guy whose idea this was for the show to begin with, this guy Zulfikar, he was saying that when he hears this song, he feels it's like it's a war cry. It's a call to battle. Do you think there's something to that, that when we hear this, dun, 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 and sing it together, that it's got something almost primitive, almost sort of bellicose to it?
Well, there is a long history, of course, of using music, either instrumental music or drumming, or in some cases singing, as a way of inducing a kind of bellicose solidarity. I'm not sure whether I would want to consider that a war cry is a fundamental aspect of human behavior. I would more want to say that using music or dance or chanted speech is a way of inducing a certain kind of social solidarity, and that social solidarity could be in the service of war, just as it could also be in the service of resistance to war. I mean, you could equally say that a bunch of protesters who are shouting "No more war, no more war" are using the same social bonding thing in completely the opposite direction.
You said before about how happy we are when we do this, when we sing together in a sort of communal sense.
Yeah, happy, or at least powerful, a feeling of collective power. Yeah.
Why don't we do it more often? Are we afraid to sing in public on our own, or does it have, the group have to be there?
It's curious. I mean, I think this is because there is, I think we have become, perhaps have always been, I don't know, but certainly in a modern age have become shy of our voices, of our singing voices at least, because you'll also be aware that a lot of the, particularly amongst men, a lot of the kind of singing of for instance, of Seven Nation Army is done with a kind of tone of voice which is, I would say, deliberately kind of raucous and shouty, as if we are embarrassed by the more, you might say, sensitive or beautiful aspects of the human voice. People are incredibly reluctant to sing in public. And I think part of that is because the voice is an extremely intimate kind of expression of a person's identity, and it's a very vulnerable, potentially, aspect of a person's identity. You know, a person who is trying to sing or speak, for instance, who is overcome by grief or happiness or whatever, and whose voice breaks. I mean, the fact that we use the word break in the voice suggests that we regard the voice as something fragile, as something that is, as I say, a very deep and powerful expression of our own identity. And therefore, it's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like being naked. It's a bit like being very, very revealed. And I think people are understandably wary of that.
So if I go and sing Seven Nation Army in a stadium tonight, screaming for my team, it's like I'm getting naked then with
everyone? Well, no, not, I think...
On that level, on that intimate level?
Not when you do it collectively, because I think that sense of kind of doing something together defends people against that feeling. But no, I'm thinking more that if you imagine going to that stadium which falls suddenly completely silent, and there you are in the middle of the field, And you now have to sing on your own, whether it's Seven Nation Army or anything else, but sing or just Happy Birthday, you're going to feel very exposed. And if your voice breaks, this is going to feel like, you know, that some aspect of your own identity is somehow at stake rather than just, here is my voice.
Eric Clark, professor of music psychology at Oxford. We are going to take a break from the Seven Nation Army now, a well-deserved break, but we are going to stick with music and what it can do to us. Music, as we've just heard, can be used to unite and bind us together, and this has real power, which can be used for good and bad. If you'll forgive me the pun, music can be instrumentalized, and nobody was better at this than the Nazis. It's often overlooked, but music was one of the most important ingredients in the Nazi brainwashing cookbook. Just how central was the role of music back then? Here's Britta Svers, professor of the cultural anthropology of music at the University of Bern in Switzerland.
Well, definitely a very central one, because it was a central instrument, actually, to, say, influence people on many levels. For instance, like if you go to the kindergarten level, this is also probably the best example, because the Nazis didn't really, you could say, exchange all the songs. So children didn't just sing marching songs and so on, but it was mixed. So you had a kind of harmless children's song like Hänschen Klein.
Hänschen Klein ging allein in die weite Welt hinein.
And then maybe you had a war song.
Adolf Hitler ist unser Retter, unser Held, der edelste Führer auf der ganzen, ganzen Welt.
At a young age, you don't really differentiate what is good and bad so clearly as you do as an adult. Children just adapted these songs as regular, normal songs. To the extent that they could still memorize all these songs 40, 50 years later.
The singing of songs in the kindergarten is of national political importance. It strengthens the spirit, it instills discipline and order in the singers. On top of that, it influences the character by demanding willpower and self-mastering from each individual singer. The breeding ground of national political spirit and action is found in the kindergarten. An excerpt from the German magazine Kindergarten from 1941.
I met a guy here in Bonn. He was born in 1964. So
yes.
Way, way after the end of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
He can still identify with Nazi music, as he was telling me, Nazi music. He said mm-hmm. He still likes it, which I found
yeah.
I found completely bizarre, because it seems to me like that would be something that your average German would be revolting for your average German. How do you think that has made it through the generations to even today?
Because I think it's, we think about the Nazi period in black and white. So that it was really, I mean, sometimes you wonder, like, how could this all have worked so nicely out, and why did all the Germans go along with it? But if you look at it more closely, you can see that these mechanisms were just not about that you had the kind of obvious propaganda songs. I mean, people are not completely stupid, and they also rebelled against that. But these mechanisms rather utilized more subtle means. For instance, just to give you one example, maybe, if you look at the Christmas songs, Christianity was a kind of target for the Nazis. And because it was also related to, so you could say, bourgeois culture, etc., so that was also considered to be an enemy of the whole Nazi movement. So what they did was that they tried to, you could say, neutralize Christmas songs by just erasing the Christian context. And so, for instance, there is a Christmas song called Es ist für uns eine Zeit angekommen.
Es schlafen Mäcklein und See unterm Eise, es träumt der Wald einen tiefen Traum. Es schlafen Mäcklein und See unterm Eise, es träumt der
It's about, like, you walk over fields and so on. It describes a kind of wintry atmosphere. and there's no Christian context in there. And this is an originally Swiss, actually even Swiss song, where they basically erased all the Christian references, neutralized the song, and it still exists today. And nobody knows about this context.
Do you think there's a way to compare the role of music back then to the role of music today?
Yes. So, I mean, in a way, there are similarities. We want to have, we listen to music as a kind of means of distraction. But you can easily understand, like, I mean, if you have these kind of ear-catching tunes and so on, how these mechanisms also worked during the Nazi period, for instance. Like, I mean, if you have some catchy songs, etc., or if you have learned, as I said, these songs at a very early age, you don't forget them. And so if you then also add different texts to them, it works quite nicely, and also just adding different contexts or filling people's thoughts with different ideas. And by the way, that's also a way of how many modern neo-Nazi bands work nowadays. That, for instance, there was a period in 2004-05 where some neo-Nazi, you could say the NPD, distributed free CDs in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. And then when, you could say, some cars with propaganda music drove through the little villages, people immediately recognized the songs and so on and connected to them.
Die Spezialeinheiten gegen deutsche Jugend. Volle Kraft voraus.
So in a way, the mechanisms are still at work. On a positive way or a positive level, but also on a very negative level.
Thanks there to Britta Swears of Bern University's Music Department, and that is it for this week's show. I sincerely hope you've been informed or at least interested by this edition of Spectrum. You can download the program at dw.com/spectrum, and as always, if you've got a comment or a story idea you want us to hear about, please tweet us or get in touch on Facebook or send us an email at spectrum@dw.com. I'm Gabriel Bord. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead.
I'm gonna fight them all. A seven-nation army couldn't hold me back. They're gonna rip it off, taking their time right behind my back. And I'm talking to myself at night because I can't forget. Back and forth through my mind behind a cigarette. And the message coming from my eyes says, leave it alone. Don't wanna hear about it. About it, yeah, from the queen of it.